But I think we need more examples of normalizing that need to put yourself first, because I when I was coming up to that decision, and I'll single-handedly say it was the hardest decision of my career. And it got to the point where I thought, and I'll talk a little bit about what led up to it, but I thought that stepping out was preventative. Like, I thought that I was, you know, I'm intervening at the right time because I'm not completely burnt out yet, so I can, you know, make sure that I'm looking after myself at the right time. Absolutely not. It wasn't until I'd had a little bit of a break, and I don't even know, like a month or two, that I really realized how genuinely exhausted I was to my bones. Which I think is somewhat terrifying. To your point, it was that mentality, just keep swimming, and you just keep swimming. And then, you know, I'd gotten past the point where it actually took a really long time. I had a period of time that I couldn't even open my laptop. I was like, I just can't. I have to get outside. I have to be moving. I have to be, you know, in nature. I need to recuperate because I was just so exhausted.
Hi, I'm Diana, certified career strategist, leadership, and sales coach. Welcome to the Spotlight Project, where you'll be listening to a one-time, raw, and unfiltered career conversation of everyday people willing to share their stories. This podcast is being recorded on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Spotlight Project podcast, where we shine a light on people's unique career stories. As you know, I'm your hostess, Diana Chung, and I'm so excited because I'm here today with a really great friend of mine and also a really great mentor, Elizabeth Stewart. It sounds weird to call her Elizabeth. I always call her Libby. Libby and I met a few years ago when she actually hired me for my very first role in tech. She's been super pivotal in my career, and I'm so excited to have her because she's had an incredibly fascinating career journey. She specialized in supporting leaders and teams how to translate a lot of their strategic vision into real work that actually makes a difference. She's coached executives. She's built and scaled teams. She's going to do her own bio. I promise I'll get there. tech, org, psych, all the things, and just a great person to talk to in general about life and work. And now in a phase of transition in her career, which we're excited to dig into. So welcome, Lib.
Hi, Diana. Thanks for having me here.
So weird to hear you call me Diana. What's your nickname for me?
Typically D, Dubs, anything that pops into mind when I'm talking to you.
Exactly. Anyone who comes to this podcast, really, this is just an excuse for me to record conversations with my friends. This is all that this has become.
Anyways, I was gonna say, welcome, I think Lib. In Australia it's normal to have a nickname, so I feel like it's weird calling you Diana too. And call me Libby, don't call me Elizabeth, that's weird too.
Yeah, or call you like Miss Elizabeth, we can make it even more weird.
Stop it.
But welcome, Lib. So I'd love for you to introduce yourself to the audience, obviously with your own words. So I'd love for you to tell us your pronouns and maybe a brief description of the work you've done so far. I know you've done a breadth of work, but just in general, what would you say has sort of been your motto or your line of work?
Yeah, of course. So hello, everyone. My pronouns are she, her, hers. And look, I mean, I think you've done a great summary of my background. There's a lot of bits and pieces you've popped on there. But if I was to kind of step back and kind of think about, you know, what's defined my career, it's really been that kind of question of like, how do we unlock our potential at work? And how do we feel really good about it? You know, let's face it, we spend a ton of time, you know, at work. You know, we spend majority of our lives actually there, and it's a massive part of our social identity. So as part of that, we really should be thinking about how can we be more fulfilled in what we do? And then, you know, how can companies then, of course, reap the benefits of having like really fulfilled employees? So obviously that's then what led me into my behavioral science background, which then quite naturally led me into sort of, you know, coaching, performance, leadership development, kind of doing that across the board in Australia. And then when I sort of hopped across the pond into Canada, I jumped into SaaS and tech, and I was working for all of those apps that enable coaching, leadership development, performance management, and all of those things. And of course, as a byproduct of sort of progressing in that industry, I then became a director of revenue functions, and then I had to drink my own champagne and start sort of embodying all of those leadership practices that I had been coaching and teaching and preaching everywhere and trying to make that part of my own practice. And lo and behold, when you actually try, you know, you can have some pretty fun work experiences. And so it's been a really cool experience, actually. And I'm sure we'll have a chance to dive into a lot of it today.
That's so honestly so beautifully said. And part of the reason why I love having these conversations with you, because you're talking about unlocking human potential, unlocking performance and great performance, and also how that impacts our identity, but also our relationship with work and what we get out of it, but also what employers get out of it is so interesting. And I think you and I, at least in this time period, have had a lot of conversations about how we both can walk the walk as people who talk a lot about performance best practices and being good coaches, but it's sometimes difficult to walk the walk, right?
Absolutely.
But we'll get into all that Jesus stuff, I am sure. So I'm really excited because I think you have a very unique perspective that people really appreciate on this podcast, because I think a lot of the reason why people want to come here is to hear about philosophies, not just around leadership, but about career and transition within career and how that impacts your life, all that good stuff. So
Lib, a lot of transitions.
So many transitions. So Lib, we'll get into the thick of your work and your career, but before we get there, I always like to start a little bit with just you as a person. And I feel so much of who people are as adults were formed a lot in their early days. So people can clearly hear you have an accent. You're not from this part of the pond. You're from somewhere else. I promised you I wouldn't put on the accent, so I'm not going to. But please, I know do. That you were, please do. I know that you're born in Papua New Guinea, but raised predominantly in Australia before you came over here. But can you tell me a little bit? I actually don't think I've ever heard this story from you. Tell me a little bit about how did you even end up being born in Papua New Guinea? Popped you over to Australia? And just like a little bit about your upbringing.
I completely forget that I was actually born in Papua New Guinea as well. It feels like a dream. Actually, when I talk to a lot of people in North America, I don't think they even know where Papua New Guinea is. So it's a little island sort of above Australia. It's not too far away. A lot of folks in Australia might be from New Guinea to begin with. My dad, way back in the day, got moved overseas. I think he was either getting moved to Hawaii or Papua New Guinea, so I think our lives might have been very different had he been placed somewhere else. But he worked for Flick Pest Control, and they actually placed him over to start their Papua New Guinea division. So our little family, I wasn't born at the time, but our little family, my elder sister, my mom and dad went over there. And then, you know, a few years in, I was born. So I was pretty much socialized into only that society for the first sort of 8 or 9 years of my life. It was a really unique experience, I think. It's a really, really interesting place. If anyone has heard of it, you'll know it's, I think it's one of the most linguistically diverse countries in the whole world. They have over 850 languages, natural resource rich. Like it's beautiful. Like it's gorgeous. We were there, weren't exactly sightseeing. It was really, really dangerous. It still is. Really dangerous for expatriates, obviously, to be traveling to. So it was kind of interesting being brought up in an environment, you know, we were in a compound. We had a really, really tight community. My family have many stories of, you know, my parents being held up at gunpoint, you know, lots of those little things that, you know, probably do shape you as a child, but that was my normal. It kind of felt like the way things were. But yeah, I think on the sort of less challenging side, it was amazing because every single friend that I had was from like a different country, a different continent, a different city. Like I didn't have any, there was no, you know, it wasn't homogenous at all in any way.
Big melting pot.
So it was, yeah, 100%. And it was really good. I think it really brought up a lot of diverse sort of perspectives as we were growing up. But it also really enhanced that kind of community idea as well. Because yeah, we had to be really closely connected and it really mattered. So I don't know, like there's a lot I could talk to on that, but it was a cool place.
What are some of your most prominent memories, either from your time in Papua New Guinea or your time in Australia, when you were like sort of on the younger spectrum, like before you hopped into work and school, that you can remember that's really informed, I guess we'll call like your core identity or like your core beliefs?
These are good questions.
I know, we go deep real fast.
Yeah, I think if I was to reflect on that and to think about just what I mentioned before, like simply having everybody around me from a completely different background, completely different orientation, background, belief systems, speaking different languages at home, just a completely different orientation. And, you know, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier too, but my mom was actually super, super religious and my dad was a complete atheist. So I think if you kind of put that all in the melding pot, the biggest thing that I had was exposure to a lot of radically different perspectives from a very young age. I don't think anything was considered, like, inverted commas, normal, you know, for me kind of growing up. And I was always appreciative of that because I think sometimes I feel that that's just informed a bit of curiosity, I guess. When I'm meeting people, I'm always super, super curious. Like, where are they coming from? What lens is this? Like, how can I better understand that perspective? And it's just this innate curiosity that I think, I believe, was informed probably from having that exposure so young.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder too, if, you know, knowing you as well as I do, do you find that also either consciously or unconsciously supported your skill in terms of holding space for tension and perhaps conflict, or like very different ideologies or very different approaches? Because I feel like if you grow up always dealing with extremes, you sort of play a role in, you know, how do I like find connection here, or how do I find synergy here? No, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was confused a lot of the time.
But I okay, it was just confusion.
So if I've ever looked blank, maybe I'm not holding space.
You're like, I was just fucking confused. Yeah,
I was very lost. That's okay. I think it definitely allows space for that. Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel like this is really interesting? Do you feel like this pushed you in terms of your education path to study psychology and org psych, or was that plucked from somewhere else?
You know, it's really funny. I've, you know, and maybe I need more therapy or something. I've never thought about how that has connected, but having this conversation, I'm like, well, perhaps, because I think when I got into psychology, and I'm sure that, you know, we'll talk to that, I think it was a bit of an aha moment for me. Like, I got in there, I'm like, oh, everything that I've done has culminated to this moment. But I think I had more tactically linked that to my work experiences and, you know, school and things. I don't think I'd really thought about it from the genesis of, you know, from a young age and like from Papua New Guinea. I think the interesting thing is it did lend itself. I've always been passionate about belonging and inclusion. Like, for me, these have been topics that, you know, throughout university, throughout school, you know, even in my friendships, I always try and be as inclusive as possible, or I feel like I have a hypervigilance around making sure that, you know, belonging is important. It's at least important to me. I want to feel like I belong. Like, that's always been sort of really important. And so I think in having this conversation, even absolutely, I think it's formed a big part of that.
Yeah. Ooh, I want to get into like the belonging inclusion part, because I think it's, you know, it's a big topic in the workspace today, but how you accomplish that is, I think, is still very ambiguous and super crazy. Oh, maybe we'll put
complex problem.
Complex problem that everyone's trying to solve. Yeah. But maybe we'll put a pin in that when we get a little bit more heavier into your actual work resume. But you mentioned that you studied psychology and organizational psychology. For someone on the outside who doesn't really know what that means, like maybe we have a vague idea. Can you define that? Like, what actually are you learning?
It's as simple as the science of people at work. That's it. So yeah, and that's like the technical definition. I'd like to add the science and the art of people at work, because I think science needs to meet practice in a far more tangible way. But when I did go into university, I didn't even know this discipline existed. So, you know, there's a lot of people I meet that are like, I have no idea. I think in my early career, there was far less recognition and visibility of like this discipline at all. But if you wanted to dive a bit deeper, I guess it applies all of those principles of psychology that we already have to systems at an organizational level, to teams and to individuals, and the intersection of all of those to then figure out, okay, well, how do people perform at work? Like, how do we ensure they're performing, they're thriving, and that we're reaping those tangible benefits? And I think sometimes what fascinates me, and that this really kind of, this is part of my fascination when I was studying, was that it's actually the simplest things that make things brain friendly. You know, systems can really nudge behavior. And oftentimes I think we put so much emphasis on individuals in a system to change everything, to fix everything. you know, you're not being inclusive enough, for example. I'm like, well, there's a lot of legacy systems from the workplace that are also driving and reinforcing these behaviors that we need to actually systemically address.
Mm.
There's a ton of research out there that can help us, but there's also a lot of experimentation that needs to happen. And so I think this is the kind of discipline that allows that experimentation. How do we actually then start to look at that a little bit differently and figure out how can we enable the best behavior?
We're getting a glimpse of the type of work that you did when you left school. But obviously you had a career in Australia before you hopped over the pond to Canada. So can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the more earlier work you did in Australia? Yeah. Did it directly relate to org psych and psychology? And
yeah, absolutely. My first role actually, so while I was studying, I was a research assistant. So I was doing a lot of that kind of academic research. I was working in, you know, a whole host of different sort of psychological research projects, and that was super cool. But then when I graduated, my first gig was actually an outplacement. So I don't even think I'd even graduated when I started. I'm pretty sure the first week of my first gig, I was part of a project team that was laying off a third of the workforce for one of the major oil and gas organizations in Australia. So it was pretty confronting. Like, you know, this is literally sitting in termination meeting after termination meeting. And then
this is early
coaching.
early on in your career, right? Just to contextualize this too. Like that's
I haven't graduated.
Yeah. That's a deep end.
Yeah. Yeah. baptism of fire. I'll never forget actually. That was like I think my first week, maybe my second month in. They had me teaching executive MBA students, which I felt like a total fraud. I remember standing, I'm like, what am I going to tell them about their career? I'm just starting mine. I actually remember giving them their first activity. I was working a lot on like, how do you position yourself? You know, where do you want to be, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd given them an activity and you know, there's a lot of silence in the room. And then one of the gentlemen, I think he was like a senior executive engineer for like one of the massive companies over in Oz. And he kind of raised his hand, and in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh my God, I didn't make any sense. No one understands me. You know, I'm terrible at this. He's like, Libby, I'm just really intimidated. I'm like, oh, why? He's like, I just don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And the whole room was like, there's like nodding going on everywhere. I'm like, oh, wow. I'm like, I can actually help with this, by the way. Like, I do know what I'm talking about when it comes to this stuff because I've been well-trained. But it was a big aha moment for me that nobody knows what they're doing.
Nobody. And the people who act like they do are just faking it.
Yeah. Anyway, I think I've gone down a tangent, but that was like my first, that was my first baptism of fire. I worked in a couple of different consulting gigs. I did some cool projects. They were more purist org psych-like projects. I worked for a few consulting firms. I did sort of some really fun, evidence-based recruitment processes for like law enforcement, where we do like behavioral role plays and things like that and assess people on, you know, inclusive and diverse behaviors. And yeah, that was actually fascinating. Like one of the specific jobs I had in one of the assessment centers we had, like you're specifically supposed to like rile people up and see what reaction they have. And which was also really intimidating because you're, you know, yelling at, you know, a police officer. trying to like evoke a reaction. So it was actually really interesting work because you're doing behavioral analysis, seeing, you know, resilience, seeing how people can escalate and de-escalate situations. So all of that was actually really, really interesting. And then a lot of sort of leadership development coaching, you know, as a result of how the people performed in their assessments and so forth. So a lot of those promotion practices. There was a lot of diversity in those roles, but I definitely, when I hopped across to Canada, it kind of shifted a little bit because then I was working in the tech space.
Yeah, which we'll get into, but I find what's really fascinating about you is a lot of people that I've talked to haven't had opportunities to apply their education so directly. Like I know I'm definitely one of those people. I studied history and English lit. And I do
nothing.
You
did not tell me this.
Yeah, I wanted to be a lawyer. Yeah.
Did I not read your resume or?
I left the lawyer thing out, by the way, which my mom brought up at my wedding. She's like, oh, remember the time you wanted to be a lawyer and quit? The grudge is strong. It's strong. But
I can't actually picture you as a lawyer. I'm glad that you didn't do that.
Yeah, that's why I'm not a lawyer. Anyway, suffice to say, I think it's really fascinating. You're maybe one of these like rare people I know in my circle who actually have an education in a very particular discipline, and the first few jobs out the gate, like they're very connected, they're very direct.
Yeah, I think the organizational psychology community over in Oz is pretty, it's well known. It's a discipline that's getting a lot of, I guess, promotion. They're doing a lot of marketing. It was actually a huge transition coming to Canada, where most people I talk to are like, I don't really understand what that is. Like, tell me more.
Yeah, for me, it looks like it's definitely a newer word too. But I'm sure it's been around for a while. You know, just never surfaced in popular dialogue.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, because it is so broad and applies to so many different things, like, I don't really, I mean, at the sake of, you know, forsaking my discipline, I don't really identify as an organizational psychologist anymore either, right? I think early on, you know, I think after doing sort of 8 years and batches of AFLA and all of that, you're really, really proud of it. And, you know, it's really, really fun. But then, you know, you get to a point where you're like, you're actually in the workplace. You're like, I love evidence-based practice. I think it's awesome. And I think we need more of it. I also think that the research needs more of the art of actually, you know, workplaces are messy. These environments are super messy. Buy-in is hard to get, you know, low-hanging fruit sometimes is how you get buy-in and you get credibility within a company to then do the big systemic change. And so I think sometimes the rigidity of that practice makes people go, oh, no, not another org psych. You know, they're going to come in and talk about rigor and ROI and metrics and this and that. Mm. We just need something done today. Just do a wellness program quick. You know, we don't need to measure all of that. Whereas we're obviously more interested in results and outcomes and making it more science, you know, focused. So I think there's a real middle ground that's necessary. And I think most practitioners at my point, like at the same point in my career, probably feel the same. I know my networks do.
Right.
Yeah.
So you've talked a little bit about coming over to Canada. I mean, so, you know, if we timeline this, it sounds like in Oz, like once you graduated, it was like 6 to 8 years doing sort of that purist org work. But what was the kicker, or what was the motivator to either think about coming to Canada and maybe shaking up your career slightly?
I was with my partner, Morgan, and you're probably going to laugh at this. Every year, he's an accountant. Every year we sit down and I make us do like this values activity.
You know, I do the same. Yeah.
Oh, you do?
Oh, I knew you nerd were. Alert. Hardcore. Yeah. Yeah. You do a values activity.
We do. Yeah. Big bowl of wine. Let's sit down. Let's think about what we want to do. And let's think about who we are as people. And, you know, is our life really fulfilling us right now? Or, you know, what do we want next? And, we had big butcher's paper and pens and things. So we were scribbling down all the things we wanted. There was a lot of adventure, new experiences, you know, that kind of thing coming up. So then we're like, well, lowest hanging fruit, what are the easiest visas? A lot of our mates, they headed over to London. There's tons of Aussies in London. But the whole drinking culture for us and the pub scene, as great as that is, it's not really kind of drives us. I looked at Canada. I've never been here before, actually. And we're like, wow, BC looks absolutely stunning. Just beautiful. And I just didn't feel like it would be a wrong decision to just go. So we kind of made a plan. Got a little vision board together, as you do. Applied for our visas. And I think it was exactly a year later, we came over to Canada, and I literally moved straight over here without ever having stepped foot in Vancouver before. So before I came over, like, I mean, my first role had been career transition coaching. So if I didn't practice what I preach, you know, that'd be pretty, pretty sad. I had been spamming folks on LinkedIn, you know, I don't know, 6 months before we came over, just sort of, you know, reaching out, saying hi to everybody, saying I'm in the same industry that I'd be moving. Would they be open to catching up either virtually or for a coffee? And just so that I could find out. I obviously tried to look up people that looked like they were connectors and then ask other people for connectors. You know, who's who in the zoo kind of thing in Vancouver. So I was trying to just really sort of do my... Yeah.
Another Libby.
I found out who was who. And then, you know, this was back 2017, I think. And so this was a time like pre-COVID, and we have to remember remote hiring was not a thing. But Wendy Patfong at Seven Keys picked up my resume and called me, and we had some virtual interviews. And, you know, they were the first company that were really open to hiring me without ever having like met me in person. So I actually had the role nailed down a couple of months before we landed. Of course, they're like, you know, still come into the office so that we can make sure, you know, you're an actual human being, you know, before we go ahead with everything. But at the time, that was pretty rare, which is kind of weird to think about now. because we do so much remote hiring. But I was really, really lucky in that regard. When I came over though, my partner, you know, he was looking for work, and I noticed that when I was talking to folks, one of the most interesting things I found about Vancouver is how much, local experience was valued so much more so over global experience.
Interesting.
And, you know, it was really fascinating to me because meeting other immigrants from everywhere else as well. Yeah, they were like, oh, you know, I've got a PhD back in my home country, but no one seems to care here. It was, it was really, really bizarre, actually. Yeah, I wasn't expecting that. Yeah, breaking in was, you know, and I was politely persistent, obviously, in landing something. But, you know, it wasn't necessarily easy. Right. If I had put that much effort in, and of course, from your home country, if I had put that much effort in Oz, of course, it would have been a lot easier. So also the market's smaller. Like it's just a more tight-knit community in Vancouver. So there was, I think, probably quite a few reasons for it. But that experience in particular for me definitely then fed into my ethos when I was hiring my team at Senegis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about, I guess, like the meat and potato. Well, not the meat and potatoes, because you're sort of midway through your career by the time you came over here, had lots of experience already. But this is a time you also pivoted industry into tech. You sort of put on a little bit of a different hat because you were then hired as a director of CS, or a major way to a director of CS position, which now required you to like build and scale customer service teams. So it's not only like hiring, coaching, performance managing your own team and individuals, it's also like building the function. You had to do this at like multiple startup tech companies too. So like, can you give us the real deal about what it was like essentially to enter a company and build a function and start almost from like a scratch baseline?
I feel like everyone in tech says this, but I really mean it. It's scrappy. It's so scrappy. You always feel like you're octopus arms, right? Like you're doing 50 things at once. You're blue sky and you're in the reeds. You're kind of hopping in and out all the time, and you're hopping around. It's like every process you're doing, you're building from the ground up. Like there is no foundation. Like if there's anything that, oh, we should have this. Yeah, well, we don't, we need to build it. And like every single step of the way. And I don't know if I am sort of answering your question here, but there were a few big transitions in that.
Yeah.
So to your point, jumping into tech, you know, before I was, you know, a direct consultant kind of building things relatively manually. Okay, now I have to get used to SaaS. SaaS is different. Now, you know, I'm an internal subject matter expert and I'm partnering with our customers to do this and flying. I was actually, again, pre-COVID, we were flying to our global customers. I probably spent, I would say, up to 6 months of the year traveling at that time because we were building and we were doing a lot of discovery about. I'll take a step back. The app that we had at Seven Geese, obviously being performance management, meant that we were nudging complex behavioral change. We were asking people to do something really tough. Objectives and key results are not an easy goal setting method for any organization, which is why if you do it, you'll get great results. And performance management isn't easy to complement with that. And so when you're asking customers to do that, you can't just turn the app on. This isn't payroll. So, you know, we had to go over, and what we found, you know, as part of our travel, like we were meeting with customers and doing discovery, what we found is, you know, particularly at that executive level, which we know with change management, getting that buy-in, getting that sponsorship, and actually helping them translate their strategic plan into goals, that was one of the biggest areas that companies needed help with. So that and the change management support. So in doing that, we're like, okay, for a period of time, we're going to have to do a bit of heavy lifting here, so that we can help product adoption. And then with these insights, we then build it in right into the product and start figuring out what are the key areas we address. So I was part of that process, with my predecessor, a director of customer success. You know, we put in the hard yards in kind of doing that and running a lot of sort of executive leadership sessions, which sounds straightforward in that, oh, you're just turning the strat plan into goals, when realistically you're turning up and you're kind of strat planning in stealth mode, because I don't know if you've ever walked into a room and said, everybody, we clear on our strategic priorities. Awesome. Can you just hand me the document? Never happened. Do we all agree on this? You know, are you all happy with this? Can I just make your goals now? No, like,
yeah, it's not how it works.
About an hour or two, and I've just flown here for like 15 hours. So that was the first step, and that was the professional services side of things. And then we were like thinking, okay, well, how do then we translate some lighter touch aspects of this into our CS delivery as well? And what are some ways we could do that? But as you know, Diana, as a member of our team, we did everything from, implementation to renewal to expansion to,
It was an end-to-end service, but end-to-end is kind of what it's what you expect in startup. To your point around Scrappy, like if I were to define Scrappy, it's like you put on multiple hats and you just make it work.
100%. And so, that's what that became. And then, of course our team grew and we recruited wonderful people like you. When the team started to expand, to your point as well, like we're like, okay, we're in a phase of scaling now. This is not sustainable to keep up, this heavy lift. And I think anybody else in a space where they have sort of a high touch service offering or customer success offering knows that scaling is critical.
I think something you talked about earlier, at least early on in your career, was this idea of being a fraud and like blah, 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 imposter syndrome. We all know what this is. But I think, I'm a career coach, you're a career coach. A lot of the thing I hear all the time is like, either when I step into a new position or a new industry, I feel like if I don't have enough knowledge as another person in the room, or in your instance, I'm a fresh graduate or like someone who's only 6 years in my career sitting in front of a CEO who has run this company for 30 years. And in your situation, coaching them on how to implement their strategic vision. Right, like I've heard you say, like, I have never felt so fraud in my life to walk into a room with a bunch of executive and essentially not tell them how to do their job, but like guide them in setting a business course for their companies. And so I don't know where my question is. How did you manage through that? Or did you just, is it one of those things where you're like, I just have to swallow the fact that I feel like a fucking fraud and I just move through it?
Yeah. I mean, just even letting it sink in, it's kind of amazing to think about. I recall, even the first few meetings. I think there's always, and I'm gonna call it out though, but it's always challenging too when you're a young female stepping into a room full of, seasoned executives, for example, to first establish credibility. That's always a big piece. And so I think I was so hyper-vigilant to that. It was always very nerve-wracking, I should say. And so I think, I don't know what everyone, they say picture people in their underwear or whatever, that doesn't work for me. But I would picture, that would be weird. I used to picture a lot of, pretty senior execs in my network, my friends, my brother-in-law, others. And I would picture, just how ridiculous they are sometimes at even cooking a meal or whatever. I'm just like, they're human. I used to try and humanize people as much as possible to try and give myself some perspective and remind myself that even just having one other person in the room, you have some value to add.
I really want to talk about leadership.
Yeah.
You and I have so many discussions around this. We alluded to in the beginning around like our gripe around some of these fluffy woo-woo leadership philosophies.
Oh, yeah.
But as someone who's like actually coached executives, leaders, have sort of science-based knowledge around this research, and also being someone who's led teams yourself, what have you narrowed good leadership down to? Do you have an ethos around this, or a couple ethoses?
I have a couple of different philosophies, I'm not sure. And I mean, I don't want to keep sort of relying on the science, but the interesting thing, I obviously have emotions around this as well from my own experiences. But one of the most interesting things is like the first leadership theory that really resonated with me was transformational leadership. I think it was Bass and Avolio. I did an assignment on it. It was like this full range leadership model. And it really jumped out at me because I thought it was all encompassing. And I did my first, you know, research project on it, et cetera, et cetera. You kind of forget all your theory, you go into leadership, you're scrappy, you just do what you can do. But time and time again, I come back to it because it's all encompassing. And I won't give a lecture on what this leadership model is, but it's all encompassing. And what I like about it is it really emphasizes the fact that you need to have transactional elements of leadership. So you need to be a manager, an effective manager, managing boundaries, reward reinforcement, all those things, like, you know, that makes sense. And you need to have an inspiring vision. And what I really like, you have to have a vision, but you also have to have, you know, individualized consideration. So you really do need to tailor your style to each individual, and the ability to learn how to flex to individuals. I mean, that in itself is a skill set, you know, that you know, takes time to develop, and it takes you sort of doing a lot of reflection to figure out, you know, am I actually adapting my style to help my team? So that was one sort of big one for me. And I think it stands the test of time. It's very all encompassing. So theoretically, if I was to say one leadership model I really love, that's it. But from, I guess, more of a, I'm going to call it like a heart perspective, my favorite out of all time, like servant leadership for me is 100% what I believe in. And like, you know, not necessarily all the, you know, nitty gritty of the model itself, but the intent behind it, which is my job is to serve others. I don't feel like I have a status here. I don't feel like I have any kind of authority. And I had leaders that demonstrated this to me. I think people often think, oh, wow, you know, that's awesome. You've got this cool title, you got a promotion and so forth. And I think the real thing we need to keep in mind is you actually now have however many people in your charge, so to speak, you know, and their well-being is all on you at work. If things are not, you know, their success is my success. It cannot be separated. If they're not performing, I'm not performing. Mm. And I think that was a big thing, I think, in coaching as well, is when people would come to me saying, you know, my direct report, they're not performing. I'm like, okay, so what are you doing?
Yeah, totally. You know, so interesting. I mean, I resonate with all those things you said. You know, I think you and I share very similar philosophies around leadership and the goal of leadership. But in everything you just said, that the word that kept coming to my mind was this idea of selflessness. It is truly sometimes a thankless and selfless position. And when I have people come to me for coaching who are like, I want a promotion, like I want to become the next manager, the next leader, my question is always why? It's like, what's motivating you to do that? Yeah. And if the answer is, I just feel like I'm owed it because I've been in this job for 6 years, or it's just the next rung up the ladder, I'm like, it's the wrong reason and you will hate this job.
Yeah.
Right? For all the things you just said, it's like, yes, it's hard skill. It's like, it's, you know, it's setting systems and rituals and like all those things. It's some of those things. But so much of it is how do I know when to push and pull? How do I understand this person? How do I build trust? And that could look different from Becky to Bob, right? Yeah. How do I know when to like challenge versus pull back? Yeah. You know, all these things you sort of said, and that is a skill.
And when I get it wrong, am I okay with being corrected and finding out?
Yeah, 100%.
And going, oh, I really screwed that up. How do I get better at this?
Yeah, totally.
Like, that's hard.
That's so hard. And like what equals micromanagers is people who want to do it for the other person, but you need to come from a place where you're like, I can't do it for you, but I'm going to like work my hardest to figure out how to get you to get there.
Yeah.
So many things. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the it's almost like, I always call it like your constant, like it's a diagnostic, but also are you willing to in the moment? Like I think as a manager, you've got 55 things on your brain and maybe there's an acquisition happening or maybe there's this, maybe there's that, whatever. And you have to be willing to in the moment, like you're having a one-on-one, I've got a million tasks and customers I need to get through with this person, and take a pause and see, oh, there's an emotion coming up here. Can I park my needs for task and go, are you okay? And then be prepared to actually spend the time to make sure that that person is, and who knows, it could be that, you know, they're intimidated by a task or they're feeling overwhelmed or whatever it is. And I think I had many of those moments where I'm like, I think you underestimate that this role, like there's an emotional labor element to this where you need to huge. It's not, you know, we so focus on, like, that's what's transactional, transformational. Like, you've got management tasks, I'm like, but you've got human beings and you're in a hybrid workspace. So I'm seeing you for, like, this snippet. Am I willing to flex my needs in this moment to meet yours? Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah. and like you and I felt we're going to get into this because you and I have been talking about the idea of burnout for a long time. You and I have experienced mm-hmm. multiple phases of burnout. And, you know, people get it in theory, but it's different when you've lived it. But I think the other side of sometimes great leadership is because you're constantly giving and you're putting other people's needs before yours or making conscious choices to park your needs. It's like, how do you find that balance where you make sure you get what you need mm-hmm. to be able to be a great leader, to be able to give? You know, how do you do that constantly? It's so hard.
Oh yeah. And it was so funny because one of the roles I had back in Oz was psychometric testing. So we used to do personality profiling. And every time I had to go, like, you know, I had one of my mates, he was an org psych as well. And he would always, like, hand her the box of tissues. They're going to cry on her again. Because we would always delve into the resilience domain of that psychometric assessment and those needs, those demands, all of those things. Like, most of my leadership coaching sessions off of the back of that were about emotion management, resilience, how people are feeling. And half the time it was just an emotional release. You know, technically we're there to talk about strategic traits and all of this stuff. It was probably, I'd say 90% of the time. And these were leaders of all levels across all agencies, across Australia. 90% of the time we get to the resilience domain and there's all these different traits that we'd be talking about how folks cope with stress and what might be coming up for them. And, you know, it would be a lot. And so I think sort of just to kind of dive into what you were talking to there, all of the time, all of these sessions became about, okay, so how do you look after yourself?
You know, you made a very conscious choice. You not like you were at the peak of your career, but you were doing exceptionally well. Mm-hmm. But you made a conscious choice to leave an organization almost a year ago because you were mm-hmm. utterly burnt out. And I know a lot of things happen in the personal life, but can you talk a little mm-hmm. bit about what burnout has felt like for you and some of the factors that led to that decision? Because I know that was not an easy decision for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think more people, we need to talk about this. And I'm actually relieved to see more people talking about this. Even to see in the headlines, you know, Jacinda Ardern resigning. Citing burnout and just, you know, words like, you know, I have nothing in the tank, but I have enough self-awareness to step out at this point in time because I know I need to focus on that, or I know I won't be the leader I want to be. Not saying that I have any of the success on the level of a prime minister stepping out. but I think we need more examples of normalizing that need to put yourself first, because I when I was coming up to that decision, and I'll single-handedly say it was the hardest decision of my career. And it got to the point where I thought, and I'll talk a little bit about what led up to it, but I thought that stepping out was preventative. Like, I thought that I was, you know, I'm intervening at the right time because I'm not completely burnt out yet, so I can, you know, make sure that I'm looking after myself at the right time. Absolutely not. It wasn't until I'd had a little bit of a break, and I don't even know, like a month or two, that I really realized how genuinely exhausted I was to my bones, which I think is somewhat terrifying. To your point, it was that mentality, just keep swimming, and you just keep swimming. And then, you know, I'd gotten past the point where it actually took a really long time. I had a period of time that I couldn't even open my laptop. I was like, I just can't. I have to get outside. I have to be moving. I have to be, you know, in nature. I need to recuperate because I was just so exhausted. It was interesting, though, because, you know, to your point, if I kind of zoom out for a second, my career has always had, like, every single time I thought, if I think of my career as like a hike, or something like that, I always thought I'd picked like something with, like, you know, a relatively challenging incline that would be quite, you know, the view would be nice, you know, when I get to the top, and this would be, you know, challenging but reasonable. And then I feel like every every single time I thought I was going on that hike, I actually ended up on a cliff face with two pickaxes, just climbing up. I would, and you know, always branded as like, oh, here's a promotion, or, you know, oh, here's the next challenge, or, oh, this is awesome, you know. And you're going, yeah, how can I say no to these opportunities? Of course, I'm not going to say no to these opportunities. And then when I, you know, got to the top, I'm like, well, yeah, cool, I can do it. You know, also, I should mention probably a few false peaks where like, oh, I thought this was the top and there's another peak. Oh,
yeah, okay, those are the worst. It's another like 10K. Yeah.
It's like, when I'm there, I'll be happy. And you kind of keep doing that. Yeah. And I think I got to the point where I was at a peak and I was like, you know what? I could take a scenic route and that might be really nice. It might be nice to take a different I'm not interested in this Beacon Valley anymore. So it was interesting. And the reason that I kind of got there is we had, you know, it had been awesome. I had a great experience at Seven Geese. We'd worked with the executive teams. We'd got the CS function up and running and it was doing really well. We had the pandemic, post-pandemic, or actually not post-pandemic, during the pandemic, we had an acquisition, which was amazing. That was what we had aimed for as a company. And, you know, it was a very successful transaction. I had stayed there for 9 months to help with that transitional process. And then at the end of that, I had hopped across to another local sort of tech organization as well. And it was at that point in time that I started having some challenges with my leg. So I'd had some knee operations. And so the first time the meniscus popped, I mean, that seems relatively normal. And I went into hospital and then it ended up being three consecutive surgeries, which ended up being sort of 6 to 7 months in a wheelchair. I'd gone from running 6 days a week to being completely immobile, pretty much. And you know, completely dependent and, you know, on lots of medication and things. And then that was at the same time I was ramping for like a pretty significant role. So it was a much larger team, a much more complex organization as well. And then sort of right at the end of that last surgery, unfortunately, my dad passed away. And he was back in Australia, and that happened really, really quickly. So yeah, it was kind of this consecutive chain of events. And then, you know, even in processing my dad's passing, you know, because of COVID, I couldn't get back to Australia in time. So that was, you know, single-handedly like the hardest thing to watch, I think, and probably the reason I couldn't open, I had to watch everything happen on Zoom. And I think for me that the association there was quite jarring. Yeah. And then trying to get back into the country was really, really difficult. And there's a whole story there as well. But it certainly wasn't made easy. So I think following that, you know, I continued to work for a while, but I think my perspective had changed. And I just got to the point where, you know, I wasn't really in a great position to, like, you know, in a similar, I didn't have a lot in my tank, you know. I just rehabbed three times consecutively. I just fought to get across the world. I just processed the grief of someone that was probably one of the most important people in my life. And, you know, was coming up to another, what felt like a cliff face with two pickaxes. and I could barely hang on.
Yeah.
And so I think it was one of those moments where I, as much as you feel like it's a choice, I don't feel like I had a choice.
Yeah, totally. I think, I mean, your particular situation was quite unique in that you had a lot of external things outside of your control that definitely exasperated your exhaustion. But yeah. I think what's interesting, your whole peak analogy, I mean, you already climbed two peaks before all this stuff happened, and you're ramping with your third and fourth. And so there's still like residual, probably exhaustion even before all that other external stuff happened.
100%.
But like, you and I have talked about this. I think for women like us who care, who we value responsibility and integrity, and we care a lot about showing up, doing the right thing, being reliable, but then you pay a price. Mm-hmm. So what would you have done differently if this situation were to happen again? Like, is this something you looked at yourself at to go like, what did I do that contributed to this?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think people had been telling, like, was it Morgan said, if there's a word to describe me, it's intensity. Morgan's my partner.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and actually I recently saw a quote, like, I would go for broke. So if there's a goal in mind, you know, I throw absolutely everything at it. And I think it's one of those perspectives of, you know, I'm not going to be too harsh on myself because, you know, if I hadn't put in all that effort, I wouldn't have got to where I got to. But the recognition is what got me here won't get me there. And, you know, I say that. And of course, there are a ton of things I've learned over the last year that I would do differently, or that I would incorporate into my everyday practice. What was really quite unique about my scenario is quite active as a person. So movement's always been important for me. It was really interesting when movement got taken out of the equation, because movement had been like my primary resilience coping strategy. And, you know, for some weird way, like movement got completely taken. Like, what do you do when you can't move? And you're still working however many hours a day, back to back, you know, back to back Zoom calls, you're in meetings and you're doing everything. And so I think my reflection on that was making sure that your restorative practices and your recuperation practices are more holistic, you know, having a ton of those healthy habits. Of course, I believe firmly that better boundary management is always.
It's hard.
And I mean, it's so hard to figure out as well. And to your point as well, I care so deeply about, you know, being showing up the way I want to show up for people. I have no doubt that I could have, and you know, it's like you can. I could have pushed through. I would have been an absolute mess. You know, it's that whole, you know, I've been so many years, and here's the other piece, so many years rewarded for being this work warrior.
Yes.
For getting the positivity badge. Libby's really can do. She can do it all. Like, you know, all that life. And she's so happy all the time. I'm like, yeah, there's happy and there's manic. Like, let's.
Yes, fine line. Fine line. Yeah, totally.
What's the difference?
It gets performative.
And, yeah. It was performative. I felt like a puppet.
Yeah. And I think that adds to the exhaustion. Brené Brown always talks about armor. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, it gets to the point where you're like, I'm tired of holding up this armor, wearing this armor anymore. But then the other side of that is you feel incredibly raw because you just rip it all off because you can't stand it anymore, right? Which is a whole other bag of fuckery.
Total bag.
Total bag. But yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, what I'm hearing you say in this, and I think this is easier said than done, but like, how can especially women like us find better holistic wellness practices, but also like balance.
Yeah.
Within our commitment.
I think it's balance.
Yeah. And it's not like working less hard or being less committed, because I also think you can't uncode those things out of our DNA. Mm. But we could do a better job of being less crazy with it.
I don't want this to be taken out of context, but I feel like I just wish I could have cared just a bit less.
Totally. Yeah, less fucks.
Right.
Yeah.
Less bucks. Just and I'm and more effective that way, because to your point earlier, if we're not looking after ourselves, how can we look after others?
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, this is the thing. We coach this, Diana. We coach this. We're constantly trying to help others with this. You know, was it plumber with a leaky tap? Totally guilty of it, you know, myself, in doing that. And I think that's been an awesome opportunity for reflection. The other thing that's an interesting reflection too is, you know, as much as like, and we should, like, identity with work is important and we should be proud of what we do and fulfilled. And there's a point that's like, how much of my identity is in what I do? And what a challenge. I think one of the most terrifying things about stepping away from that for me was like, well, who am I without this? Mm-hmm. Because I have put so much into this.
100%. Yeah.
And that this year, I actually made a conscious effort this year. There was a few things, like when I was interacting with people, I just wouldn't bring up what I do at all. I just 100% was just more curious enough. And not because I was like being super deliberate, I just didn't want to talk. I was exhausted. I don't want to talk about it. But you know, also it was so refreshing to just not, like, to not even care and be like, oh, you know, I'm just Libby. Like, I like to kayak sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's also,
I have a dog. But,
totally.
You know.
But I think it's like a societal norm too. Like, think about it. When you meet someone, what's the first thing you get asked, right? What do you do for a living?
Yeah.
What do you do for work? It's
always. Like,
it's just an encoded part of us. And I've reflected a lot about that. Cause like now when I meet people, the first thing I want to ask is not, what do you do for work? It's more like, tell me about like, your life. Yeah.
Yeah.
I also think it's a question.
It's awesome. And I think what it affords you to do too, and I think those questions in stepping away for me is I kind of also went, how did I end up here? You know, how did I end up so far? Like when I first went into what I did, you know, I was so motivated, and I'm going to use the cheesy word impact. I know everyone wants impact. But I really didn't feel as connected to my purpose, I guess. And so I think it was a really, you know, it's been a really, like the year I have felt completely untethered over the last, you know, 6 to 9 months or so, completely untethered. It's been up and down. It's been awesome. It's been challenging. It's been great. It's also been a great opportunity for me, like, to do things I've never done before. I was volunteering in a few different places, and those experiences were awesome. And I was really learning. I was like, this is why I did what I did in the first place. This is why. And that was the stuff, rehab and the movement. I would just get outside. I was just like moving, walking, meditating, you know, eating well, like just really basic stuff, and volunteering and community, like tapping it and really, really realizing how many missed opportunities, like my friendships, I think, were suffering.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I've had so many people come to me this year like, oh, this has been great. Like, you know, the conversations that I've had have been, you know, exponential. And I know we don't always have the capacity when we're working, but when we're exhausted, yeah, just having room for that connection, it's been incredible. And I think it's been a perspective shift. And to your point earlier, I had no idea like how deep the burnout had gone until I had that perspective. Yeah.
Yeah, what I would love to see more dialogue on is, like, you know, more acceptance around these sort of, we call it dormant seasons or winter seasons, where you, right, like, if you're in a position where you can take some, you don't, and not everyone has to take a 6 to 9 month sabbatical like you and I, you know, some people are not financially privileged to do so.
Of course.
But so in addition to balance or like better boundary practices, like while you're working, it's also like, we should allow more opportunities for people to recalibrate, because I think when you take the time to do inner work and like really focus on rediscovering yourself, your interests, like the magic of your life,
yep,
it opens up some incredible opportunities. I'm sounding really spiritual, but I think, you know, there's something to karma and to energy and to, and I found that too. You know, on the edge of uncertainty, it's terrifying, but it's also really beautiful at the same time.
And I think it's so important. I really like what you've mentioned there, because actually an analogy that made me feel better all the time was, you know, in winter, everything's resting, you know, but spring, everything comes to life. And I like that idea of like, in this season of my life, this is where, like, I'll rise again. I can totally rely on the fact that once I get a whiff of energy, it's going to happen. Like, it's kind of funny though, giving yourself permission, because it is really difficult when you're so used to being like productivity focused, or, you know, your definition of success is doing things,
right,
to then be okay with existing, and also being patient with yourself.
Totally.
There are many times where I'm like, why aren't I feeling better by now, or whatever that is.
Yeah.
And you just have to be patient.
I think I think we're getting to sort of the meat of the burnout piece, but I think if I were to pull some things that you said in there, it's one, again, how do we find better balance within our existing rituals, right? So you don't reach that stage where you're like, I am done to my bones, right? Second, like more acceptance around recalibration time and like allowing ourselves to like nourish and rest and all those things. And I think the third around this for me that I've heard you sort of say is, I don't know, maybe it was just those two. I had a third and now I can't get there. I'll get there
eventually. We talked about a lot of stuff.
It was a lot of things. I was trying to summarize. But I think that's it. So I'm hoping people listening to this, if you feel sort of similarly, listen to the cues. I think that's another important thing.
It's a lot of the Gabor Mate work. I was fascinated by. Yeah. And it's a lot about listen to the body's whispers before it screams. I really found that really interesting.
Yeah. So to bring this home, Lib, let's talk a little bit. I know you're still recalibrating, you're still in your dormant season. And so the future is still open for you, which is totally fine. I love that for you. But what's been on your brain, you know, when you're ready to return back to work or do some things, like what have you been thinking about for what's next?
Yeah. You know, it's been really interesting because reflecting on sort of my values and like during this time, it's kind of funny, like I took a bit of a break and then I started leaning into volunteering and then I started type-A-ing that a bit and going too hard and ramping up. But as part of that, I recognized that I was ready to work again. I just, you know, just needed to make sure that it was aligned work. So as part of my next steps, I've already started sort of freelancing, which I'm really enjoying because that's part of the autonomy that I was looking for, that flexibility I was looking for. Obviously, like it's a bit of an interesting market that we're going into this year. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of that baby steps approach where now I can really feel that compass going, is this something that I want to do? And to your point earlier, I feel very privileged and lucky that I have that ability and that choice at this point in time. I actually don't know if any point prior to this in my life or any point after I will have that privilege. So I kind of seized the moment while I could. But yeah, so there's some ideas brewing. I have a few amazing women, yourself included, on my hit list for collaborations. And it's actually been really exciting how much creativity has been coming up now that I had never previously felt like I could tackle. I'm really excited.
Yeah, it's amazing what creativity does and letting your mind be able to wander with ideas and sort of imagine and daydream. It's actually amazing what that does for energy.
Yeah,
and for motivation, even if the ideas don't go anywhere, it's the fact that you're like, this could be cool.
And there's so much adage to like people saying, just let yourself get bored and yes, see what happens.
Your mind will fill itself. It happens. Totally.
Yeah. I have a lot of whiteboards. Yeah.
Well, I'm really excited. I'm like excited to see what unfolds for you. I think no matter what, it's going to be awesome because it's
lit. Well, you're going to be part of it.
I know. I'm not going anywhere.
I've got grand plans.
You wrote me in. I know. So I like to end this lib with what I call like the lightning round, just a series of questions I ask every guest because I think that the answers are always interesting. So the first question is, you know, what will always continue to be true about the way you make choices in your career?
Ooh, lead with your values always. And every job I've ever taken, even if one has more financial gain over the other, I have, you know, as much as I've wanted to go down one path, I've always led with that compass. And I always reassess it. I think always. And I now that they're shifting, there's different seasons and different needs for different seasons, I think making sure that I am dialed into that.
Absolutely. But I think in order to lead with your values, you have to know your values.
Oh, yeah.
Thing, and, right? Yeah.
I mean, that got drummed into us, didn't it? Like, if you're a career coach that doesn't assess your values.
Yeah, you're not a good career coach. Yeah.
I got to practice what I preach on one front.
Yeah. What's, I mean, you've done a lot of amazing things, but personally, what have you been the most proud of so far in your career?
Do you know what? I'm proud of stepping away when I needed to. I really am, because out of everything that I've done, that was the hardest thing to, in my mind at the time, it felt like admitting failure. When really I felt like I was letting people down. I felt like I was letting my team down, letting my VP down, who was exceptional over at my last organization. And at the same time, I'm really proud of myself for the first time in my career, I prioritize my needs.
Yes.
And it was, you know, it took a long time to feel proud. I didn't even want to talk to you on this podcast about it, to be honest, for a long time.
Yeah, it was like multiple rescheduling. Like, I can't handle this. It's okay.
I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. The shame is deep. The shame is deep.
Runs deep.
Yeah, totally.
But I'm really proud of taking that time because the practice is out of it. Like I do feel like I've come back to myself, which feels good.
That's great. Yeah. When you're not working or doing your day job, like what do people find you doing, or where can they find you? So clearly movement's a big thing for you. Your dog's a big thing. What are the other things in your life?
Holding my poodle. I love the outdoors. I love BC, the outdoors. I'm in Revelstoke at the moment. We've been here for a few months. We're probably going to be here for more. I just want to get outside. We've been snowboarding this season, which is awesome. Anything and everything that involves being outside. Yeah.
Yeah. You love the outside.
I do. Yeah. Well, after being trapped indoors for so long, I'm very much an advocate for getting outside.
Maximize, totally. And the last question, which again, I think is the most important one for the listener. What is the one big thing you would want to share with other people just trying to figure out their careers?
Oof. Everyone's so different in their path. And so I think if I was to go, what would I tell at least myself if I went back? And maybe that's advice for others as well. It's all going to be okay. Calm your farm, chill out, take a breather, and do what's right for you, because it will work out, you know, rely on yourself in that way. I think, so if I think if I go back to myself, the amount of times where I think it was unnecessary to put myself, you know, through my paces, and yet achieved a lot. And at the same time, I think, you know, to your point earlier, you know, that sustainability long-term, really think about how you're looking after yourself long-term.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is all going to be okay. Like you really do figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. And every time you think you can't, like, just if you can lean in and just, I can, you know, you can't control everything.
No, surrender.
You know, this is one of those things, surrender to it. That has been, and I'm still working on that. Still working on that, because, you know, you can type A anything. I think I was even trying to type A my, like, my restorative practices at the beginning. I'm like, oh, this is not the point.
Yeah, you're like, I'm gonna rest.
Meditate every day. I'm gonna rehab. I'm gonna chiro and acupuncture. Everyone was like, you need to calm down about your rehab. So yeah, I think just, you know, take a breather, chill out, it'll be fine.
And then Liv, if people, I mean, you and I talked about this, you're an incredibly open person. I think it can be very intimidating for someone's like, I want some advice on career, what it's like to work in tech, what it's like to work out in CS, what it's like to be a leader. But I think you're very open to connection. So if people wanted to 100%. Find you, what's the best way to reach you? And also, do you have like a preferred approach as well when people reach out?
Just reach out on LinkedIn. Like, I'm out there. Shoot me a message and let's go from there. I'm pretty easy on that front.
Yeah, she's very approachable, people.
I don't know if it's our culture or what.
She loves gifts, she loves memes, she loves a good joke. Or like a gif of a potato.
For a meme. Potatoes. What was that about?
Who knows? Okay, Liv, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much for being here. Hope you enjoyed your time. Really love the conversation. And to everyone, until next time.